Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
From the Wholesaling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. This is the Home Plate Podcast with Ryan Port and Calvin Smith. Talking all things baseball in the city of Nashville.
Just a bit outside.
On Nashville's best sports talk.
ESPN.
102.5 The Game.
Happy holidays, everybody, and welcome in to the Home Plate Podcast. ESPN 102.5 The Game. And thegamenashville.com. Ryan Porth, Calvin Smith here with you for some baseball talk around the holidays. Calvin, how we doing?
Good. It's nice. We're going to gather around the hot stove here on around Christmas time. Talk a little bit of Christmas music and a lot of baseball.
We're not gathering around the Christmas tree. We are gathering around the hot stove.
I thought that was very funny of me. Thank you.
I could not have thought of that myself, so...
Well, it's just part of being a distinguished MTSU alumni like I am now.
That's what happens when you go to college. I didn't go to college, so yeah. I didn't get that education to then lead me to opening a podcast with that.
Exactly. See, that's where your journalism degree really comes into play. See, if you had one of those, I can only imagine how far you would have made it, Ryan.
I know. So we have a lot to digest in a short amount of time here with the winter, with the offseason so far, the winter meetings just a couple weeks ago, and there were fireworks at the winter meetings. The biggest free agents all left the shelf at Christmas time before people could even do their holiday shopping. And Calvin, we'll get to all of that later on in the podcast with our winners and losers of the offseason so far. But we have an exciting guest today here on the podcast. We welcome in Harold Reynolds of MLB Network here on the Home Plate Podcast. Harold, thank you so much for joining us here in Nashville, and I hear you're going to be in Nashville next week for a cool event called Talking Hitting with you and current Marlins manager Don Mattingly.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. We do these hitting exhibitions around the country, and it's the first time I've done one with Donnie, but it's going to be great. Put a microphone on me, microphone on him, and let him go to work, picking him questions and just kind of talking about hitting, what he did back when he was a big all-star player and what they're teaching now, and really just talking about hitting and the art of it and how to hit a baseball. So we'll do that at McGorvick. Am I saying that right?
McGavick.
McGavick High School in the gymnasium. And we'll do that at 7 p.m. on the 2nd on Thursday. Free to the public. Doors open at 6:30. And we draw anywhere from 2,500 to 3,000 people. So make sure you get there early, get a good seat. And it's going to be great.
So, and this event is also presented by Huddle, is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, Huddle, most people are familiar with Huddle through football. If you have any kids that are teenagers, football, soccer, basketball, lacrosse, those are the big sports. We're trying to launch it with baseball now. Kids can have their own individual platforms, and coaches all across the country can find them, and plus Little League coaches or whoever else. Or in my case, I live on the East Coast, and I grew up out west, so I put my kids on there so all my family on the West Coast can just dial in and see what they did in a Little League game on the weekend. So it's pretty cool. Huddle's been a great platform, and there's about 7 million kids that use Huddle, and we want to launch baseball and softball into this arena as well. And throw softball in there because it's the fastest-growing sport in the country, and the females are killing it, and they're getting a chance to get to colleges. And if you've ever watched the Women's College World Series, it's an special event. So a lot of things are happening, very positive with Huddle, and they're doing great things.
Harold, how would you say the art of or the development of hitting has changed since you played?
Well, it's just become more complicated. I think we way overthink. You know, when I was coming up, it was see it and hit it. And that principle has not changed. I think we try to do too many things in the swing. You know, everybody wants to hit home runs and make sure you hit this side of the field. And for us, it was wherever the ball was thrown, you hit it that direction, kept it real simple. And I think those principles still apply. If you talk to any top hitter, whether it's Mike Trout or Howie Kendrick or Cody Bellinger or whoever else you talk to, the simpler, the better. And as you get older, you know, we're hearing about launch angles and exit velocities, all those things. Those things have always applied. We just didn't have the data to register it. But that all came with major league players who've had thousands of some swings, and you knew your swing real well. So I want to get back down to the basic principles that can apply whether you're little league or high school, college, major league, superstar, whatever, and that's see the ball and hit it. So we'll go from there and build from there.
Well, Harold, when you say keep it simple in your swing, what does that mean to you in terms of going from your stance to the load and then following through?
Well, I think you got basic principles. Obviously, you hit with balance. So if you take your body and you stand in an athletic position, whether you're guarding somebody in basketball, whether you're a linebacker or running back in football, or whether you're a baseball player as an infielder, you're shoulder width apart from your feet, and you start from there. You got to have a foundation. Then just take the bat and set it on your shoulder and then lift it off your shoulder. That's your basic fundamental foundation of how to hit. And the rest comes with seeing the ball and hitting. But it starts with having a proper base and a proper foundation. And that's what I mean by keep it simple. You know, we have a leg kick, or we have a spread open stance or a closed stance. Start with the basics, and then you build from there.
To what extent do you see launch angle thoughts and all these things coming out of StatCast changing the way young high schoolers and middle school baseball players swing their bats nowadays compared to how they might have used to?
Well, I don't think you're able to cover the whole strike zone, and you don't know your swing well enough. You know, if I go back to when I played 80s and 90s and my kids go, Dad, it was so far, long ago. But if I go back then, that did not change. You know, you still had 30 or 40 home run guys. You had guys that could hit in different counts. I think the difference is the strikeouts. And so what guys did when I played and what I would teach if I was a hitting coach, it's real simple. 1-0, 2-0, 3-1, those hitters counts. And you want to drive a ball? Go ahead. Try to drive a ball out. We used to call that a home run swing. Now they call it a launch angle. And the difference was we used it in certain counts. Now they're using it in 0-1, 0-2, every count. And now you're seeing guys strike out 150, 200 times. A strikeout does you no good. You don't advance the runner. You don't put any pressure on the pitcher. It's of no value. So what I'm saying is, guys back in the day, even if you struck out 100 times, you'd get ridiculed. And so I think you have to get back to putting the ball in play, and you should have a swing for every situation. And hopefully that's where baseball starts to see that turn. You're starting to see that trend a little bit more.
Harold Reynolds of MLB Network here with us on the Home Plate Podcast. Harold, big money going to Gerrit Cole with the New York Yankees this offseason, $324 million. For the right-hander, do you think Gerrit Cole is going to bring a World Series to the Yankees?
You sure hope so. You know, it's hard. It's not guaranteed. I can't sit here and say, yeah, he's going to definitely do it. Baseball's such a unique sport. Right now, though, he's the hottest property in the sport. Hasn't been injured. He's young. He's going to dominate for a number of years. I don't know if the $324 million will, at the end of the day, when you look back 9 years from now, go, yeah, that was worth it. But I think for now, and what you see the next 3 or 4 to 5 years, you're not even going to think about the number when you see him pitch. He's that dominant. He's that on right now. And it's great for the sport. You either love the Yankees or you hate them. And anytime the Yankees are good, it's good for baseball.
I saw Fran Charles and Kevin Millar talking about this yesterday on Intentional Talk about how a lot of the big market teams like the Dodgers and the Cubs and the Red Sox have been pretty quiet this offseason. How surprised have you been that a team like the Dodgers with all that money and the Cubs and the Red Sox with all the things that you hear they want to do, that they've been pretty quiet this offseason?
Well, you got to look at what they built. You know, the Dodgers are going to have to pay Cody Bellinger. You're going to have to eventually pay Walker Buehler. You're going to have to pay Gavin Lux, who they won't give up. You go around the diamond, Seager. You know, so they've got a stockpile of young talent. I think they got to look at and say, how are we going to pay these guys and keep them in our fold, or do we go spend it on one player in Gerrit Cole? I think that's what they look at. You look at Boston, the reason they didn't make a lot of moves this winter you got Mookie Betts sitting there going, well, Mike Trout's $500 million, and I just saw a pitcher get $324. So you got to figure out what are you going to do with Mookie Betts. So I think the big teams that really didn't do a whole lot, the reason they're good and they've been big and dominant for the last 4 or 5 years is because of what they've done with their young players, and they built that. And eventually those young players are going to get to the point where they got to get paid. And that's when the decisions have to be made. So if you look at Cleveland, they made those great runs. They're in the World Series even. But now Francisco Lindor is knocking on the door of free agency, and you're sitting there going, we're in Cleveland. Can we afford to pay Francisco Lindor $300 or $400 million? That's why his name's on the block. So I think they have to look at the full picture, not right now, but maybe 3 or 4 years down the road. And that's why they haven't made moves.
Harold, when you see a team like the Atlanta Braves, here in Nashville, we're pretty firmly in Braves country, and they seem to be ready to compete right now. I mean, they had a great year last year, but they still have a really rich farm system. When you look at this organization, how should they be balancing, you know, trading away some of their top prospects, maybe the Ian Andersons and Drew Waters, to pour some fuel on the fire right now?
Well, you got to look at your windows. Do you think this is a window where you can win it right now? And one trend that's happened in baseball is we value the prospect way more than any other time in baseball history. And I think clubs have overvalued the prospects. I've always valued, do I have a chance to win a World Series? Because those don't come out that often, especially in our sport. If you look at it, we very rarely have repeat teams win it, and it's very difficult to do. I think it's been 20-some years since the Core Four, the Yankees, repeated. It's been that long. So your window of opportunity is not that great. And when you have that opportunity, then you got to go ahead and take advantage of it and shoot for it. And I think that's what the Yankees or different teams like that look at and say, this is our window, this is our time. And so when it comes to the Braves, I think this is their window. I think they're in that window right now, and I think they got to invest in it and go get it done.
Speaking of the Braves, would you put Ronald Acuna in the same breath as the likes of Mike Trout or Mookie Betts or that top tier of stars in baseball?
Not yet. I don't see it. I still think there's some immature moments, which we experienced even in the postseason. He's still got some swing and miss, but he's talented. He's going to be in the next few years, no doubt. But I still think he's got some holes. He's got some things to work on. I think he would say that as well. You look at Mookie Betts and Trout, they're so seasoned and they're so consistent. I know what I'm going to get right now, today, if the season started. I know what Trout's going to give me. I know what Mookie's going to give me. Can I honestly say that about Ronald Acuna? Do I know he'll give me 30 homers again and 100 RBIs? I know Trout will. I know Mookie will. Will he do that? And that's the difference with a young guy and a veteran guy. I know what I can get, what I'm penciling in right now, today, if we were to play a game here in December.
When you talk about immature moments from a young player, are correcting those and growing from that just a product of time and him growing as a person and being older than 23 years old? Or is it have more to do with the manager, Brian Snitker, or someone taking them under their wing?
I think it's a combination. I think it comes even from the top of the organization, from ownership down. I played with Ken Griffey Jr. when he was 19 and 20, and he did stuff that, you know, he learned and grew from. But, you know, for example, we lost a game in Minnesota. He hit a ball, and he stood there like Acuna did and went off the bag. He wasn't a home run. And he got thrown out at second, and, you know, everybody was talking to him about it. And he actually sat up in front of the team and said, I let you down, because the batting order came back around for his spot, long story short. But I remember having a meeting, getting called into a meeting with our general manager and with the president of the club, with Griffey, myself, and Alvin Davis. And they brought in Griffey's mom and came into the meeting. He was 19 at this time. And for this particular meeting, he wouldn't take off his earrings. All right? It was we had a dress code. You got to take your earrings off. Even though he got there early, hit extra, did all things you're supposed to do, they were hung up on his earrings, which would be laughable today, right? But this is 1986 or whatever. And so we have this meeting, and the general manager's explaining he's got to, you know, adhere to the team rules, and this is one of the rules. And his mom looked at them and said, well, he listens to me at home. This is something you've created. And she got up and walked out. And so basically, she said, it's up to you guys to discipline him. Don't call me in another meeting. He does not act like this at home. He listens to me. And that was like a tipping point of the management understanding, hold it, we got to step up here, not just the players on the team or the manager, but management. And never had a problem with Griffey. He was perfect. He was a great, great teammate, great person. But that was that gauntlet was laid down early, and it was with ownership. And so that was how you have to deal with it. And I know the Braves have to do the same thing. We watched Bobby Cox for years, bench guys. But Bobby ran the whole organization. You know, Snitker doesn't have that kind of power. This is going to have to come from the GM, from ownership, to sit down and say, this is what we expect of you. And if not, I'm giving the manager freedom to bench you. And if that's not everybody on the same page, it will never get done.
That was a great story about Ken Griffey Jr. And Ken Griffey Jr., as a kid in Cincinnati, as a huge Reds fan, Ken Griffey Jr. was by far one of my favorite players growing up. And I wanted to know what it was like, Harold, for you to play with not only Jr., but Ken Griffey Sr. on the same Mariners team back in the early 90s.
It was one of the great experiences I think I had in my whole pro career. I mean, first it was Jr. before his dad showed up. And I always tell people he was so talented that he wasted 3 years of the big leagues by going to high school. I mean, that's how good he was. And so to play with him and his dad, I think his dad allowed Junior to have his personality like you would see at home in the living room. He laughed, he smiled, he joked. It just relieved the whole pressure valve off of Junior to be himself even more so. And I think without him playing with his dad, I think Ken was 21 or 20 in that neighborhood, and he was really becoming the star of baseball. We couldn't go anywhere without people wanting his autograph, an interview, everything else. And that's a lot to throw on a 20-year-old. And having his dad around, show him how to do interviews. It's okay to laugh at yourself. Smile on the field. You know, I think the best highlight was when he came over and he took the ball away from his dad. He caught a fly ball in front of him. That showed everybody their personalities. But I think his dad really allowed us to get a peek into who Junior really was. And it allowed him to be himself that we saw in the locker room out on the field. And I think because he played with his dad, it took him to that stardom level of being able to wear his hat backwards and not worrying about it, to smile on the field and really be the kid. And that was, I think, a lot had to do with playing with his dad.
Do you ever look back on Junior's career, the back half of his career, all the injury riddled seasons with the Reds, and think what could have been in terms of the home run record?
Yeah, he would have obliterated it. I don't think people understand the player he was before he went to Cincinnati. You saw a shell of who he was. Because in Seattle, he was averaging 50 homers a year when he left. And at that time, he's what, 28, 29?
27?
I mean, he's in the prime of his career. And we're watching Mike Trout right now. Griffey was hitting 50 home runs a season. And just imagine, he would have done that had he stayed healthy in his sleep. He still hit 30-some and ended up with 600-plus home runs. With injuries, he probably missed in that period of time over 2.5, maybe 3 years with being on a disabled list. So he was, the injuries got him, and he still was able to put up the numbers he did. But those years in Seattle before the injuries, I don't think you saw anybody like him. He was that unique and that different.
Harold, I'm just a little bit curious about you. Obviously, baseball has been a huge part of your life, and the 162-game grind of an MLB season is one of the most difficult and challenging in sports. How do you deal with, you know, playing your whole career doing that and then transitioning, working for the MLB Network, doing MLB Tonight, then the hot stove in the offseason? How do you balance baseball and your own personal life?
Well, the broadcasting's easy. I'd be talking about it anyway. You know, that's how I look at it. And so I'd rather be sitting on TV talking about it amongst a bunch of people. The studying and all that just comes with being around it. So it's not like I'm going home and reading every stat on everybody. When I'm there every day, I'm there for 4, 5, 7 hours. You're seeing a lot of games and you're seeing everybody. So it's easy to keep up. And I guess the way I explain it at home is I'd be talking about it anyway. So that's fine. I've always had a motor for sports. I've always loved it and always participated in it. So it was just an easy transition from a work management or workload standpoint. As a player, I always went to spring training with the goal in mind of playing 162 games. And I think our generation was blessed to have Cal Ripken in it, because it was easy to sit there and go, if he can do that, I can do that. And he played every day for basically 20 years. And so if Cal could do that, you had no excuses. And so it gave you a mindset of, I want to play 162 games. And that was really the mindset of, I think, most of our generation of players. It was a disappointment to play 130 games or 125 games. You were looking to go play 162.
Harold Reynolds of MLB Network has been our guest here on the Home Plate Podcast. The event is Thursday night, January 2nd, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at McGavick High School here in Nashville. Harold, you'll be with current Marlins manager Don Mattingly at this event called Talking Hitting. We hope a lot of people come out, and thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. And you guys are going to get to see a side of Don Mattingly that I got a chance to witness playing against, because he was one of the greatest players and hitters of that generation. So it's going to be a great night. Make sure you get there early. Gates open at 6:30. The doors do. And grab a seat, because there'll be about 3,000 people. Free to the public. It's going to be awesome. So thank you.
Love it. Thank you, Harold. Harold Reynolds of the MLB Network right there. Calvin, a whole lot of good stuff from HR, specifically on Ken Griffey Jr. I wasn't really planning on going down that road with him, but a whole lot of good stuff there on Griffey Jr. And you were telling me before we hit the air that Griffey, that there's some legendary story. I've never heard this one here in Nashville.
A little bit of folklore. It's very, very low-key. You have to be in tune to the baseball community here in Nashville. My old coach, P.J. Polk, told me this. And fun fact about P.J. Polk real quick. He beat Golden Tate in a race in high school. They both graduated the same year. There's a picture in the newspaper of P.J. dusting Golden Tate. He played in the minors for a little bit. But Ken Griffey Jr. at Shelby Park, Old Timers Field. It's been around for a long time here in Nashville. And rumor has it that Ken Griffey Jr. stood at the plate and looked out to that outfield wall and saw the outfield wall. Then there's a little road before you hit the Cumberland River. It's probably, I don't know, 40, 50 feet, maybe past the wall, where it goes from 330 to 375 in the gaps. Rumor has it Ken Griffey Jr. hit the ball from home plate all the way into the Cumberland River, which would probably be like 450, 460, 470 feet as a high schooler, Ken Griffey Jr. Granted, in the 80s, they were using some crazy bats that were basically like crack cocaine for baseball bats made of metal. But that's the legend of Ken Griffey Jr. right here in Nashville.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me with how good Griffey was at such a young age.
Well, it's believable because of how good he was.
Exactly. So we appreciate Harold Reynolds for joining us again. Talking Hitting with Harold and Don Mattingly at McGavick High School here in Nashville, Thursday, January 2nd from 7 to 8:30. Hope you can head on out there and learn a lot of cool tools about hitting the baseball and just baseball in general from two former major leaguers like HR and Don Mattingly. And now, Calvin, we get into our winners and losers of the offseason. We react to what has gone down to this point, and we start with Gerrit Cole, $324 million. Steven Strasburg returning to the Nationals at $245 million, and Anthony Rendon to the Los Angeles Angels at $245 million.
A ton of money went very, very quickly. Like they were ordering from Amazon Prime or something like that, because they got them all so quickly. And really, with baseball right now, this is the best case scenario for Major League Baseball. I mean, everybody was smashing this league for, oh my gosh, everybody needs to sign quicker. Like, it's got to get going. The ball's got to get rolling. Well, I would be shocked if the MLB corporate offices didn't have a little bit to do with all of this happening in a very short window, and they got good national attention for
it. You think so? You think Major League Baseball said to all 30 teams, hey, let's not sit on our hands this offseason?
I don't know the method by which they would do it or what they would dangle over their heads, but it certainly seems too, it makes a little bit too much sense, and there has to be a way that Major League Baseball could reach out to agents and teams alike and say, hey guys, you know, we understand there's business to be done and leverage can be played both ways, but we really think it's better if you guys sign quicker.
It just seemed like there were a lot more suitors for these top free agents than, say, last year when it was Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. It was almost like process of elimination of teams that were A, interested in the players, but B, capable of spending the money to obtain those players. Whereas this offseason, it felt like it was an arms race to get Gerrit Cole, to get Steven Strasburg, even Anthony Rendon, and all of that activity caused there to be a whole lot of bidding, and Scott Boras was able to nail down those deals in San Diego.
Which is weird, because Boras clients, they're notorious for being willing to wait it out into January, into February, into March, but here we are, and I just would not be surprised if something came out that Major League Baseball heavily incentivized or pushed in some way this to get done sooner.
Well, it all started with Steven Strasburg re-signing with the Nationals, and when Steven Strasburg got $245 million, you knew Gerrit Cole was going to break the bank, and Gerrit Cole broke the bank with the New York Yankees. He no longer has his scruff. He had to shave it all off because he's now a New York Yankee. He looks about 10 years younger when he was donning the pinstripes for the first time. $324 million for Gerrit Cole. Do you think that's going to be a worthy investment for the New York Yankees?
For the next 3 years? Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've said it several times on this podcast that I don't think Gerrit Cole will repeat what he did in Houston. He was too good. I mean, really, like for what he was with the Astros, top three pitcher in baseball.
For sure.
Given he was a former very highly touted pick, but he wasn't that guy in Pittsburgh, goes to Houston, is a Cy Young candidate for a few years, and now he goes to New York. I just question how sustainable that is. But over the next 3 years, you certainly expect Gerrit Cole to be a good pitcher. So, over the next 5 years, you expect Gerrit Cole to be a good pitcher. But on the back end after 5 years, it's going to be abysmal. Good thing the Yankees and money are best friends.
So who would be your biggest winner so far this offseason?
I would say Major League Baseball is the biggest winner of this offseason. First of all, for the reason I mentioned earlier, that they got this deal done and they weren't sharply criticized in the media like they were last year, because baseball has such a PR problem at times with a lot of people and people with influence, because when it took so long for the deals last year to get done, people were like, oh, like baseball needs to generate excitement. Like that's their problem right now. They need to generate excitement. Well, they came out and they did it this offseason, and they did it well. Another thing that I think is kind of not going to slip under the rug, but something baseball did that was very proactive and kind of precedent setting in terms of professional sports, is what they did with their new drug policy legislation. And they changed it around to test more for opioids, go to a more substance abuse program treatment rehab model instead of more suspensions, and especially with things like marijuana that are now treated like alcohol. And then obviously in the wake of Tyler Skaggs' death, opioid rehabilitation and treatment is more of a focus.
My biggest winner is Scott Boras. $814 million alone between Cole, Strasburg, and Rendon. And that doesn't that does not factor in his other clients that he has helped strike deals this offseason for. Just between Cole, Strasburg, and Rendon, I heard that he makes 5% of what they make.
God. An agent getting 5%, that's good.
$41 million. For Scott Boras, that he guaranteed himself with these contracts.
So he just got a new vacation home.
Or three.
Oh my God.
I mean, he could build a beach house in Hilton Head, in Destin, and maybe in New York as well.
Aspen, Colorado. He already lives out in LA or San Diego or wherever.
Vail, Colorado.
Gosh. Okay, when we talk about Aspen and Vail, like those are like my dream vacation homes right there. So that hit personal to my soul.
Okay, so you're more of a skiing type guy than a beach type guy.
Well, fun fact, I've never been skiing or snowboarding. That's number two on my bucket list of my life. But
okay, what's number one?
see the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis in Alaska, number one. But yeah, beach and Calvin, like, it's all right, but what am I going to do there? Sit on the beach?
Sure.
That's no fun to me. Okay.
You can go in the water.
I don't like salty water. I would give me a mountain retreat where I can sit out and be with nature and see these great, grand, majestic views. But I digress. Scott Boras made insane bank, and it gets underrated sometimes how much these agents are able to make and how incentivized they are. And Scott Boras getting 5% shows his value as an agent, because that's a little bit higher than what other agents make.
Well, I think we're getting. Well, I think we're in the wrong industry, Calvin.
Oh yeah, we're in the wrong industry.
We should have become agents.
Well, it's funny because I've looked into it a little bit just because I'm curious about that process of becoming an agent, and it's really, really, really hard. I mean, you talk about law degrees and these tests you have to take to become an agent. You've got to be really, really smart, and a high, high percentage of people who want to become agents actually fail out and never even get the chance to represent someone. And then the ones who do pass the test and get to do it have to either join one of Scott Boras's or someone like that's big corporation and just be kind of a small cog in a huge machine, or fight them and you will lose that fight.
Exactly. So those were our biggest winners. The show Biggest Loser, I heard, is coming back. Unrelated.
Really?
Yeah, whatever. So, unrelated, but related at the same time. Who would be your biggest loser of the offseason so far?
The Los Angeles Angels did a classic, as far as I know from them, Los Angeles Angels move. I like Anthony Rendon as a player. I think he's very, very good. But, what was it, 7 years, $245 million?
Mm-hmm.
Too much. And the Angels need to seriously evaluate what they're doing as an organization, because I think they continue to think that going out and making signings like that are what's going to help push them over the edge when they're not even close to the edge. Like, they're probably four steps from the edge, and Anthony Rendon brings them one closer, and they're still three steps away. And the assets out there that they can use to get there just aren't available to get them to the point they want to get to, where they're actually contending for a World Series.
See, I think you also have to... This is on a much smaller scale, but the fact that they also spent $9 million on Julio Teheran.
Oh.
What are you doing?
As the Braves fan here, you don't want Julio Teheran. I promise.
They have no pitching. They traded for Dylan Bundy from the Orioles, who...
Not a good pitcher.
...has been completely...
A bust.
Yes, I was going to say underwhelming. Compared to his draft slot. And then you have Julio Teheran, and those are your pitching acquisitions to go with an already just awful rotation.
I can't explain it. I mean, this is what they did with Pujols. They did it with, his name literally.
Josh Hamilton.
Josh Hamilton, Dan Heron, a few years ago.
Dan Heron.
Like, guys who were good. But, and I think Anthony Rendon is better than both of those players, because Anthony Rendon's been at an MVP level for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of 2 years from now, what Anthony Rendon's going to be, and in terms of where your team is and getting you to playoff contention, this is a move that reeks of and is a desperate move.
By the time they get the pitching, Rendon may not be that MVP caliber player anymore.
Oh, no. Trout's not going to be an MVP caliber player by the time they're ready to go.
I'm not ready to go that far. I mean, Trout feels like a player that is going to be great for a long time.
For 10 more years. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying about the Angels. I don't believe in anything they've done over the past several seasons about their ability to build a roster that can compete. And they're about to lose their GM because he's making this move. He went and signed these players because he knows his job is on the line. And what do you do when your job's on the line? You make desperate moves that are Hail Marys. And this is a Hail Mary that won't work. And then when the new GM comes in, he has to inherit this contract, a couple other contracts that'll be on the books still, and he's got to work through that. Then they've got to tear it all down and rebuild, and they've got to do something with Trout and Joe Adell, who's coming up. It's going to take a while for them to, if they actually want to sit back and hit the reset button, or they want to, over a few years, push the spending button smartly and not on 31-year-old third baseman. Well, no disrespect to Anthony Rendon, because he's good, but he's not the guy the Angels should be targeting given the state of where they are.
I would have gone after, and they probably did. This isn't to say they didn't go after a Strasburg or a Cole or a Mad Bum.
Yeah.
But those were the players that the Angels should be going after. offense is not the problem.
No.
With the LA Angels.
No.
Now, Rendon is 29. Don't sell him short.
Did I say 31?
You said 31. Rendon is 29.
I'm sorry, Anthony Rendon.
Yeah.
I apologize.
I'm sure he's listening, and I'm sure he accepts your apology.
Well, I know he's an avid fan. I texted him before we came in here and told him I was going to rail on him.
You gave him a heads up.
Yeah, please,
that was nice of you.
Please take that for the joke that it is if you're listening. I don't have Anthony Rendon's phone number.
My biggest loser is the Cleveland Indians.
Yes.
Because of what they did last week and what they're about to do, which is they traded Corey Kluber for pennies on the dollar.
Yes, they
that
did.
That was basically a salary dump. From the Cleveland Indians, trading away Corey Kluber. Now, I know he went through injuries last year, and he may never be the same pitcher again. But you traded Kluber. You're about to trade Francisco Lindor. All signs point to Lindor getting traded.
Yes.
And if you're trading Kluber and Lindor, say goodbye to contending for the playoffs. And then I think that raises the question of this core with the Indians that they have built up, and they are now starting to tear down. Was this a successful run for the Indians?
Absolutely. There's no
Even
doubt.
No, they don't have the World Series.
They made the World Series.
They did,
and they were a team who could contend. And I think that's
and they
more,
blew it.
But that's a lot more than you could say for a lot of things that happened in this Indians organization. And I think you can attribute a lot of what happened in that World Series to crappy luck. Not and to say that they blew it. Yes, they absolutely did.
They're up 3-1.
Yes, they did. But at the same time, it's not like you're an organizational failure because you lost in the World Series. It's disappointing,
right?
But the ride they gave their fans was still fun and a lot more than basically every other organization can say about what they've given to their fans. And they aren't that historically rich franchise. So what they built was impressive, and I don't consider it a failure.
If they were a historically rich franchise, then we would be looking back on this core saying it was a failure.
Why aren't they refueling? Why aren't they pouring gas on the fire right now is what we would probably be saying.
Right. And why aren't they adding instead of subtracting and tearing this thing down?
And if you are a team out there like the Atlanta Braves or the Cincinnati Reds or someone who's looking to pour gas on their fire, the price doesn't matter for Francisco Lindor.
I am trading Nick Senzel, Jonathan India, and a really good pitching prospect if I'm the Cincinnati Reds. I might throw Jesse Winker in there to get Francisco Lindor.
On the last podcast we did, I talked about the Braves needing to go make these kind of moves. And I said about Francisco Lindor, and there is no prospect in that organization that's off limits for Francisco Lindor. Christian Pache, Drew Waters, Ian Anderson. Obviously
and you
not.
You love them.
Yes.
You adore them.
I mean, Pache, I think Lindor is the only person who will be available that you could trade Pache for. Now, obviously, you're not going to get him straight up, and obviously, you don't bundle Waters, Anderson, Pache all into one to go get Francisco Lindor.
Mm-hmm.
That's too heavy of a price. But one of them included in the deal, your top three prospects in the organization? Yes.
There's no doubt. I'll give you another loser. Madison Bumgarner.
Why?
All the rumors were that he was going to make over $100 million. He ends up with 85, and he went to the Diamondbacks. Why, as Madison Bumgarner, why are you going to the Diamondbacks?
Why are the Diamondbacks signing him?
It's just an awkward fit. And I know the Diamondbacks do this, once every 3 or 4 years, they make a big signing.
And they got a lot out of Greinke when they did it.
They did.
And they flipped him to the Astros.
And they got a lot back in
they
return.
They did.
But
they're going to do the same thing with Bumgarner.
I don't think in 3 years, though, you're going to get a similar payoff in terms of a trade.
Well, Greinke was older than Bumgarner when he signed that deal with them, when he was with them.
Really?
He's 36 now, right?
True. I always have this
To me, Zach Greinke's 27.
That their ages are flipped. Because Mad Bum, it just feels like he's been around forever.
What's crazy is Zach Greinke took that leave of absence from the game, too, and that gets kind of lost that he didn't play in the bigs for a few years because he was dealing with some health problems.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's a good fit for Mad Bum. He got less money than what was expected, so I'm calling him a loser, although we would all consider ourselves winners if we were guaranteed 85.
Oh, yeah. Also, Hyunjin Ryu, winner, 4 years, $80 million. Good for him.
With the Blue Jays.
I don't know if he's worth $20 million. He's good. He was good last year for sure. But over the next 4 years,
No.
Good for him. He made his money.
He was worth $20 million last year with the Dodgers.
Yeah, he was worth $30
million. Not for the next four with Toronto.
No. They paid for what happened, not what will happen.
Exactly. So that leads us to our favorite segment of the week, and that is Around the Horn.
Starting it off, we talked about this guy, Anthony Rendon, to the Angels. He left the Nationals. The Nationals, it came out that they did not have the money to bring back both World Series MVP Steven Strasburg and star third baseman Anthony Rendon. They elected to go after and pay the big money to Steven Strasburg, and I think they paid the correct player. Ryan, do you think they paid the right guy?
I do not. I believe I would have signed Rendon and not Strasburg, because you already have Scherzer, you already have Corbin in that rotation, and you had the best 3-4 in baseball in Juan Soto and Anthony Rendon, and it's going to be very hard to replicate that offensively moving forward. I would have gone with Anthony Rendon. He's 2 years younger than Strasburg, and he is consistent, and he's been consistently on an upward trajectory in the last 5 years, whereas Strasburg has been a little bit more hit and miss. Yes. He was a huge hit in the World Series and the postseason, one of the best postseasons ever for a pitcher. But you never know if his arm is going to fall off here in the next couple years. I mean, he's 31. I would have gone with Rendon.
I say keep Strasburg, because you talked about keeping that dynamic two they had with Soto and Rendon intact, but the three you have in Strasburg, Scherzer, and Corbin is among the best in the entire in all of Major League Baseball, and there may not be much of a question about it. That's how good they are. I think keeping that intact, as well as the fact that you drafted Strasburg, you developed Strasburg, there he won the World Series MVP with your organization. That's the kind of person you keep around.
I disagree. Well, I don't disagree with that sentiment, but
yes,
but I do disagree with your thought on Rendon and Strasburg, because it's going to be so hard to replace Anthony Rendon offensively.
Second topic of the day, the best rotations in Major League Baseball right now. Well, I got to it a little bit in the last segment, but ESPN released an article that used a projection evaluation, Bill Jamesian style formula, that calculated up some of the best rotations in baseball coming into this year, and it considers things like injury history and ability to recover from things like that. Their top three were the Washington Nationals, the New York Yankees, who just signed Gerrit Cole, and the New York Mets at number three. DeGrom, Syndergaard, and Stroman is their top three.
And they signed Porcello to a one-year deal, which I thought was very shrewd of the Mets. They don't typically do shrewd things in the offseason. I thought signing Porcello to a one-year deal was pretty smart.
Isn't it such a shame that I could have that good of a rotation and not be any good?
Yes. That is an absolute shame, because that franchise is such a sham.
Number four on the list, your Cincinnati Reds.
My
Ryan
Reds.
Porth, Trevor Bauer, Luis Castillo, Sonny Gray, and then other guys who are on the periphery.
Yes, they just signed Wade Miley. They were in the running for Zach Wheeler.
They were, but I think, I'm not even sure I'd pay Zach Wheeler what he got,
which was 5 years over $100 million.
Yes. Good pitcher, but worth that kind of money? Miss me with it.
I will be interested to see if the Reds use one of those top three as a trade chip in the next couple years.
Well, we've talked about this with the Reds in the past, that them contending for a legitimate World Series title, probably not.
They need more offense, but you're in a winnable division if you're the Cincinnati Reds.
You are, and that's why they probably want to pour this gas on the fire right now.
And all you got to do is just get in. The Washington Nationals proved that.
And they have a good enough rotation to do something. Is it as good as the Nationals?
No.
But it's good enough to maybe make some magic happen and advance around.
They need one or two more bats for me to feel confident that there could be something there.
One bat named Francisco Lindor would be nice.
It would go a long way.
Not even that far away.
That it would go a long way. You stack your top of the order with Lindor, Votto, Suarez, and Moustakas, you're going to win a lot of games with that rotation.
Coming to Major League Baseball in 2020 is a new rule. The three batter minimum that got talked about a good bit leading into this season, and now in 2020, it will be in effect. Meaning a pitcher has to either end the inning or face three batters before he can come out of the game. It's going to eliminate these specialists who come in for one batter or really just a few pitches to face one guy to throw maybe the same pitch twice to get the out and get out. Ryan, I think this is an absolutely great and proactive move by Major League Baseball.
No more loogies.
No more loogies.
Which we should subscribe to that theory all the time. No loogies. I do feel for the left-handed relievers, though, because they make a lot of money to get one or two outs in an inning. And now their job is going to be that much tougher because they're going to have to stay in longer.
Yes, and they won't be as effective.
Right, and not just come in for one batter. And I would be interested to see after this upcoming season in 2020, I would be very interested to see how some of the best left-handed relievers, not just closers, but just relievers, how their numbers kind of fare compared to previous years where they are forced to face more right-handed hitters.
Or left-handed hitters who hit those kind of pitchers well.
Right. So that will be very interesting to see. I do agree with you, though. I like it. I think this is good for baseball, and hopefully it speeds up games.
I think it's a proactive move, because if this had taken a few more years and baseball had started to see revenue issues or serious like complaints that were affecting their bottom line or product on the field to a significant extent, it would be reactive. But Major League Baseball saw this, recognized it within a few years of it happening at the scale it's growing at, and saying, no, we're going to fix the game. Well, really fix the game only if you saw it as a problem. I didn't see it as much of a problem. But changing the game to better make, to improve their product.
Mm-hmm.
Good, proactive move.
I think this will definitely speed up innings 7 through, well, let's say 6 through 8. Because
there have
been way too many times where it's lefty-righty-lefty in an inning, and the manager goes and gets a lefty, then a righty, then a lefty, and it just drags out the game and the inning. I think this will speed it up for sure.
And speeding it up will be very good for baseball. And Ryan, for our final Around the Horn topic, we want to get a little bit festive.
Yes.
It is that time of year. So we will bring our most under and overrated Christmas songs to the table. And we can start off with yours, because I was kind of surprised you picked this one, because I don't hate it that much. But here's a little bit of a taste.
Santa baby, slip the sable under the tree.
I just don't like this song.
It sounds weird.
It sounds like creepy to me.
Like she's whispering in your ear or something while you lay down.
Anytime this comes on, I just want to find a different Christmas song.
It's just
to listen to.
Kind of weird. Sexualizing Santa. A little bit weird to
yes.
be. And I understand why you don't hate that one, but it's not my least favorite Christmas song.
You mean don't like that one?
What'd I say?
Don't hate it?
No, yes, sorry. I don't like that one.
I hate that song.
I'm very lukewarm on it. Like, I can listen to it and be okay, but I'm not gonna leave the room. But if I hear this song, I'm going to break your radio or your speaker.
I want a hippopotamus.
Stop it! I don't even understand. The whole premise of the song is just ridiculous. A hippopotamus? This spoiled little brat girl sings that because she wants an unrealistic gift. I don't like it.
Is that a girl or a boy?
I think the singer is Gayla Peavy. And on the YouTube video I'm playing this from, it's a little girl with a silly little picture of a hippopotamus.
I think you could make the case that it is a boy.
If it's a boy, that's spoiled little boy. I don't like this song in the slightest. As I'm
like
going to turn it down.
I mean, don't like it. Yeah, just turn that all the way off.
My problem is I just don't even understand why you would want a hippopotamus.
That's probably the reason why it became a huge hit, is that it was so out there.
Oh, it's out there.
Yeah.
Like, every time it came on when I was little, I'm like, this just doesn't make sense to me. Like, I don't understand. The underground trade of exotic animals is a very lucrative field, I understand, but we don't need children involved in this trade around the holiday season.
I agree.
And there we go. There is our home plate podcast.
I think we both agree on the overrated Christmas songs.
Yes.
Like, you can understand why I don't like Santa Baby. I can understand why you don't like I Don't Want a Hippopotamus.
I Want a Hippopotamus.
I Want a Hippopotamus for Christmas. Like, I don't think there's any disagreements there.
But what's your favorite?
Rocking Around the Christmas Tree.
By Brenda Lee, the Brenda Lee one?
Sure, any of them.
Yes, that is...
I think it's a classic.
I think... doesn't that song play in the movie Miracle? At some point when they're having their Christmas party? I could be mistaken
yes,
there.
But yes.
It, when they're having their Christmas party, I believe the Brenda Lee version of Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree plays. And that movie and that song and Christmas time are all like synonymous in my head. So I have like a strong relationship between all of them.
Do you consider Miracle a Christmas movie because it has a Christmas scene?
Now that's a good question.
Now everyone includes Die Hard as a Christmas
never
movie.
Never seen Die Hard. Not a big movie guy here.
Yeah.
So never seen it. But
I don't consider Die Hard a Christmas movie because it has nothing to do with Christmas.
I have a, like, in my brain, there's a strong relationship between wintertime and Christmas and wintertime and Miracle. So I could see how I could relate the two as one, okay. Miracle being a Christmas movie, but it's not a Christmas movie, sadly.
I'm glad we agree on that as well.
My favorite?
Well, yeah, what's your favorite Christmas song?
Rocking Around, I mean, wrong song. I can't believe I almost said the wrong song. I almost said the song you said. Jingle Bell Rock, Bobby Helms.
Okay.
I love Jingle Bell Rock.
Okay.
I don't think enough people play it either, honestly. Like, I feel like it gets kind of fallen to the wayside because I've never heard anyone else say Jingle Bell Rock is their favorite Christmas song.
I've heard that before.
Really?
Sure.
I guess it's just me then. Because, I mean, normally people say, like, Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree or Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You.
I think that's overplayed. I don't think it's overrated.
I don't have it on my Christmas playlist because I'll hear it everywhere else.
How do you feel about artists doing their own Christmas albums?
If it's Michael Bublé, do it again and again and again.
Michael Bublé's Christmas album is fantastic.
I have every song on it, on my playlist, and I never skip it. Ever.
My fiance and I had a game night Friday night, and we had that on in the background, and it must have played like 5 times.
Good.
Through.
Good.
And I didn't even realize that it had gone through like 4 or 5 times. And I'm like, man, this is Michael Bublé's Christmas album is fantastic. It's the first time I'd ever heard it.
I'm an early starter on Christmas music. So when it got really cold here in October, like it got into the 30s in October, I busted out the Christmas music because when it gets cold for me, I'm ready for Christmas music.
Okay.
Went straight to Michael Bublé in October.
That's fair.
No shame about it.
I'll also go to Brett Eldredge. Brett Eldredge is
Not familiar with his Christmas album.
Okay, well, we will end the Home Plate podcast on that note, a very disappointing note. Your task this week is to listen to the Brett Eldredge Christmas album.
And see Die Hard. Determine if it's a Christmas movie.
Yes. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Home Plate podcast. For Calvin Smith, I'm Ryan Porth, ESPN 102.5 The Game and TheGameNashville.com. Snowing and blowing up bushels of fun. Now the
jingle hop has begun. Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.